You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, August 5th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, the executive editor of the American Prospect, David Dayan. On last week's antitrust hearings and on the post office. Then we will hear from the director of research and GiveSmart at Future Now, Aaron Kleinman, on the primaries and even more relevantly looking towards the states in the November general election. Meanwhile, as the original down goes, 10-term incumbent William Lacy Clay as the original Justice Democrat Cori Bush wins in a major upset. Up goes Medicaid coverage for over 200,000 Missourians. Shida Tlaib beats back the establishment-backed challenge, and the Republicans sadly avert disaster in Kansas. Meanwhile, a massive blast in Beirut kills over 100 and wounds thousands. Republicans are too fractured to even negotiate corona relief at this point. Meanwhile, Trump cuts the COVID National Guard funding, except for Texas and Florida. Saudi Arabia expands its nuke program. Congratulations to all you maximum pressure on Iran folks. Democrats introduce a bill banning toxic pesticides. And coronavirus now headed to low-income rural communities and about to lay bare once more the inequality in this country. All this and more on today's program. That story about the where COVID is moving is, we saw that at the front end of this pandemic. I'm not suggesting we're at the back end, but at all, frankly. But we saw it hit particularly like Queens and the Bronx in New York. In areas where they're already in low-income areas, in areas where there's less wealth, broadly speaking, and areas where public hospitals were decimated over the past 5-10 years. And we're about to see that again, except for in the less populated areas, less dense areas. In rural communities, poor rural communities where there are no ICU beds, where there is no facilities to fly people to an ICU bed. It's conceivable, I guess, states will help out with that, but I doubt it. So we're going to see some problems there. And that's just, next up on the docket. Meanwhile, we've got, great news with Cori Bush yesterday in St. Louis. That is big story. She was the first Justice Democrat in 2018, or the first Democrat who was, endorsed by the Justice Democrats. And she won this time around. It's a big boon in multiple reasons. Obviously, you're expanding the size of the squad, as it were. You are also on the Financial Services Committee because Clay was the chair, everybody moves up a step in seniority, and that is Katie Porter, AOC, a couple others, progressives on there. That's good news. There's a whole lot of good news in this, frankly. And we will talk more about that as the show goes on. And obviously, 200,000 more people getting access to Medicaid is a big deal. And it's interesting to see what's going on in a state like Missouri where, you know, where the desire to expand Medicaid is actually, it is gaining traction in the suburbs, which suggests that there is just a bigger appetite, growing appetite, even amongst the PMCs, as it were, for expansion of social programs. But we'll talk more about that as the program progresses.
Yeah, it's still a Democratic leadership.
If we could just take the dial and just crank it to 10 years from now, and all of those people who are the roadblocks in the Democratic leadership right now age out, as it were, with all due respect to them, and they, a lot of these issues would be gone. A lot of them, right? Like, even, you know, it was funny watching Hakeem Jeffries, and there's a lot of Democratic establishment younger people in their 50s who are looking at this and going, oh boy, this is a different Democratic Party. And they're going to be caught. They're going to be caught between their fealty to the past, essentially, and their self-interest that lies in the future. It's going to be interesting. And you're going to see a lot of people start to pivot. How serious they are about it is another question, but at least from a rhetorical standpoint. So folks got to be careful. But let's move on to, we had been reporting months ago that what Rick Scott had done in Florida to the unemployment process, the unemployment system, unemployment payment system, was an outrage. They had specifically built it in such a way to make it very, very difficult for people to get their unemployment, which incidentally they have paid into. Unemployment insurance is paid into by employers, which obviously comes from employees. And this is fascinating because part of the reason why there was such a push to open up Florida was a function of their not having income taxes, them relying on sales taxes. And Florida is just a disaster in many, many different ways. And Donald Trump is down there, and DeSantis is down in his popularity significantly. And he is looking for a lifeline. And here it is. Apparently, it comes in the form of throwing Senator Rick Scott under the bus. And by all means, continue.
But I mean, my thing is like a lot of these unemployment systems throughout the country, you know, weren't very good. But a lot of them are like 40, 50 years old. Ours wasn't really old. I mean, ours was really 5, 6 years ago. And it should have been done better for that price tag to produce better results.
Do you believe that the system was in part put together the way it was to discourage people from being able to collect unemployment?
I think that was the animating philosophy. I mean, having studied how it was internally constructed, I think the goal was, for whoever designed it, was let's put as many kind of pointless roads roadblocks along the way so people just say, oh, the hell with it. I'm not going to do that. And, you know, for me, let's decide on what the benefit is and let's get it out as efficiently as possible. You know, we shouldn't necessarily do these roadblocks to do it. So we have cleared a lot of those. And I waived a lot of requirements through executive order. But I think going forward, I want all our systems, including unemployment, to be user-friendly. And it was not user-friendly.
Well, that system was designed and implemented during the Rick Scott administration. Do you think that was Rick Scott's intention, was to discourage people from applying for benefits?
I'm not sure if it was his, but I think definitely in terms of how it was internally constructed, you know, it was definitely done in a way to lead to the least number of claims being paid out.
Now, he just happened to be governor at the time. I'm sure somebody was freelancing, right?
How it was internally constructed.
You're governor and just somebody internally just like, you know what? I think I'm going to make it hard for everybody to get their unemployment benefits because I, as a middle manager here in the Florida State Unemployment Division, I'm going to get a lot of benefit by putting up these roadblocks.
I love the fake naivety he shows. Like, oh, yeah, I studied this and I came to the conclusion that, like, oh, yeah, we had the best researchers money could buy look into this internal workings. And I found something that it's like, yeah, you dumbass. We know you're only acknowledging this because everybody knows this now. And it's such a disaster that even you have to admit it.
In fact, I would go a step further and say his people told that reporter, asked this question. Like he does, like, oh, well, you know, it's funny you should say that because I'm going to throw Rick Scott under the bus. Well, I'm not going to say Rick Scott. I'm just going to say his and during when he coincidentally while he was governor. And he says it very, very casually. And he does have this sort of completely naive thing like, oh, I'm throwing this off like it's not, like it's just a fact. And, you know, it's just a challenge for me as a good government type of governor, you know, who cares about getting those benefits out to people.
The buck stops at the internal construction.
Exactly. Yeah, someone internally did it. Here, play that clip of just a throwback to a woman in Starbucks as Rick Scott was running for senator.
It doesn't work. In fact, you cut Medicaid so I couldn't get Obamacare. You're an asshole. You don't care about working people. I'm not talking to you. You don't care about working people. You should be ashamed to show your face around here.
We got a million jobs.
A million jobs? Great. Who here has a great job?
You should.
Or is looking forward to finishing school? You really feel like you have a job coming up? You stripped women of access to public health care. Shame on you, Rick Scott. We depend on those services. Rich people like you don't know what to do. When poor people like us need health services, you cut them. Shame on you, Rick Scott. You're an embarrassment to our state.
Sweet.
I love the sweet at the end of that.
That's so good. So good. And now he's getting it from DeSantis. That's great. All right. We got a couple of ads, and then we're going to get to David Dayen in just about 2 or 3 minutes. I want to talk to you about something that I thought that I would never, ever do in my life. And when we were having the toilet paper shortages at the beginning of this thing, I said yes to this. It's the latest in butt cleaning technology, ladies and gentlemen. It's called water. Hello Tushy cleans your butt with a precise stream of fresh water for just $79. Not each time, just a one-time payment. It's actually super easy to set this up. It attaches to your existing toilet. You don't need any electricity. You don't need any additional plumbing. It's literally, if you got a wrench, you can do this. It cuts the toilet paper use by 80%. So the Hello Tushy bidet pays for itself in a few months. And then you also don't have to worry about, you know, toilet paper shortages. You don't wipe at all with Hello Tushy. Even the best two-ply can't cut it when it comes to a hands-free poop experience, ladies and gentlemen. so you could ditch paper products and uncomfortable chafing when you switch to the soothing, cleansing stream of water from Hello Tushy Bidet Attachment. I got to tell you, Kyle, at the beginning of this thing, said to me, goes, we just got a bidet, and it's the best thing in the world. And I was like, I don't know. But then, you know, these guys reached out, and I was like, I'll try it. And believe me, it is, I want to say it's life-changing, but it's up there. Every Hello Tushy Bidet attachment comes with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. You can join millions of Hello Tushy customers right now. Have a clean butt with every flush. Look, it's super easy to attach it. I was a little bit skeptical of the whole process, I'll be honest with you. And you're nervous the first time. I'm not going to lie. I was nervous the first time. And you're like, I can't believe this. And now you understand. Like, I grew up, I had no idea what the point was of a bidet. I do now. Believe me on this. This is one of those things I know I'm going to suggest, and people are going to pick it up, and we're going to get emails like, this has been a revelation to me. Go to hellotushy.com/majority. Get 10% off. Special offer for our listeners. Go to hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off. hellotushy.com/majority. Also, one of the things I've been doing during the pandemic, but actually, frankly, before this, is a way of building a relationship with my daughter so that she'll actually talk to me if I am not on the phone. Hunt a Killer. It's a new way to do game night. Gives us the opportunity to have fun, work together, investigate without even having to leave the house. Hunt a Killer reinvents the way we interact with murder mysteries. You go from being a viewer, safe in the comfort of your own home, sitting on your couch, to an investigator actively involved in solving a case. It's a murder mystery subscription box. It has over 2,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot. And what happens is you get a delivery, send it to you every month. They send you documents, they send you evidence, sometimes audio recordings, case files. And what you do is you basically progressively eliminate suspects, and then you figure out who the killer is. You can even join Hunt the Killer's spoiler-free online community. It has over 100,000 members. You can share theories there and help each other out. Basically, what happens is like almost like a different season of like, what was that? What's that show on HBO? I don't watch it anymore, but True Detective or something? Is that what it was?
Yes.
Okay. You know how like on True Detective, every time there would be a new case? That's what this is. So your existing case, I don't know, it's like 6 months or something like that, and then you go on to your next one. That's awesome. And you could set up like, the pins on the bulletin board. You can do the whole thing. You can get deep, deep, deep into this. Believe me. You can get into arguments. Don't go forward without me, please, you say to your daughter. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to hunttokiller.com/majority. Use the promo code majority at checkout for 20% off your first box. Head to hunttokiller.com/majority, 20% off. Show your support for the show and have some fun that does not involve a screen. Huntakiller.com/majority. And lastly, I happen to be one of those people who believes in reading the ingredients. Somewhat on obviously what I eat, but also what I allow to touch my body. I have always been super skeptical, frankly, of things like soap and deodorant. Now, I use soap, I use deodorant. But I try to avoid a lot of the chemicals that are in it. That's what I like about Native. It has ingredients you've actually heard of, like coconut oil, shea butter, tapioca starch, which I got to admit I had not heard of. It's also vegan, and it's never tested on animals. And I'll tell you, for me, the big thing is I don't want to put aluminum under my arms. Switching to an aluminum-free deodorant doesn't have to mean you sacrifice on odor protection. Native will keep you smelling and feeling fresh all day. They have over 10 scents, including rotating seasonals, coconut and vanilla, lavender and rose, cucumber and mint, citrus and herbal, to name a few. For me, of course, I think we all know, I go with the fragrance-free. That's the way I am. And it works great. It's risk-free to try. Every product comes with free shipping within the U.S. Plus, it's a 30-day return and exchange. For me, I go fragrance-free. That's it. But I've also tried the coconut and I've tried the cucumber mint. I like both those too. But, and of course, I could never even get close to the lavender. Shout out to Michael. This is where Michael would chime in and mock my allergy to lavender. But now you can do what I did. You make the switch to Native today by going to nativedeo.com/majority. That's nativedeo.com/majority. Or you can use the promo code majority at checkout. You get 20% off your first order. That's nativedeo.com/majority. And or you can use the promo code majority at checkout for 20% off your first order. All right, quick break. Be right back with David Dayan. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the executive editor of the American Prospect, which, let me just say, if you have not visited the Prospect or you do not read Unsanitized, David Dayan's daily email blast, you are making a big mistake if you're interested in knowing what's going on. David Dayan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Sam.
Oh, and I should say, author of Monopolized. We just had you on for that as well.
Yes. Monopolized Life in the Age of Corporate Power, wherever you get books.
Now, let's talk about, let's start with we'll start with the bidets, because I know you're terribly interested in that. but then we will go.
I am just interested that, I'm glad to hear that you stand behind the products that you advertise.
Well, stand behind. Thank you. I appreciate that. That was very, very well done.
That was subtle. It was subtle. No, but it was there.
Yeah. That's right. But let's go. We'll save that for the end. Let's put a pin in that, as it were. And
let's put a pin in that and then throw it away.
Yeah.
Yes.
Last week there were antitrust hearings. Yeah. We didn't hear much about them. I think they got overshadowed by the Bill Barr hearing to a certain extent. And just, you know, I think it's very hard for people to sort of wrap their heads around the idea of like government functioning in any way right now, including the House, because there haven't been any like the oversight hearings you would expect. But this was sort of a rare, you know, hopefully a glimpse into the near future in terms of two things, in terms of like government going back to actually like doing things that are, you know, that like functioning, right? I mean, in some way, just like looking into an issue and dealing with it. And the other thing is antitrust, which I think like there was going to be a big push on this 4 years ago. People were presuming Hillary Clinton would be the president, and there and all the antitrust forces were gearing up. And it feels like it's happening again. Your book, Zephyr Teachout's book, et cetera, et cetera. So tell us what happened during this hearing.
Yeah, I mean, it was on the front page of the New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal the day after the hearing. So I think it had an impact. I think that impact was buffeted by the fact that the day after the hearings, these same four companies all announced their earnings. And the earnings showed that in a quarter when economic activity fell by 33%, all four of these organizations increased their profits above expectations and brought in over $200 billion in revenue in the quarter.
We're talking, to be clear, we're talking Apple, Google, Facebook.
Facebook and Amazon. That's right. So, you know, if anything overshadowed it, it was the fact that the earnings call kind of reinforced the fact that these companies have a tremendous amount of power. And that was what was shown in the hearings. You're right to say that the actual functioning of government that we saw on display on, you know, not entirely, but largely a bipartisan basis, in this hearing, which is the culmination of a year-long investigation that was done out of, you know, solely out of the antitrust subcommittee. I mean, sometimes you hear an investigation is going on and it's really just parroting news reports. But this was an actual investigation where witnesses were gone through, where documents were recovered, where you know, inside information was revealed. And what it showed is that these companies muscle out rivals, take advantage of partners, and aggrandize their power at every step of the way. And most of the CEOs who were questioned at that hearing essentially admitted the charges that were being made by the various members of Congress.
So, like, why did they do that? Like, what were some of the bigger charges? And, like, why would they, did they just come in there and think, like, these guys aren't going to, this is just, you know, this is a joke, or are these guys just so, I guess, full of themselves that they just sort of feel like the idea of a congressman asking me a question that's going to stump me? I mean, like, how do they come in there and provide this type of fodder? And to a certain extent, let's be clear, it wasn't totally bipartisan. There was, I think there was a significant Republican contingency who wanted to basically talk about shadow banning. But, how do they come in there and just sort of, you know, lay it out
I think the subcommittee had the goods. I mean, the subcommittee, for example, let's just take Facebook. So the subcommittee had internal documents showing that Mark Zuckerberg and his chief financial officer, when they made the purchase of Instagram in 2012, were talking very openly about the fact that they needed to do this to get rid of a competitor, and that they viewed Instagram as a threat, and that they created essentially a clone of what Instagram did as leverage in the negotiation to acquire the company. In other words, what they said to Instagram was, we're going to mock up what you do, and you can either join us or we're just going to crush you because we have more users than you do, and we'll just steal all of your eyeballs. And they actually did this later with Snapchat, right? They made the same ultimatum to Snapchat. Snapchat said no, and they just copied what Snapchat does. It's called Facebook Stories, and sought to reduce their market share. So you know, when you have that documentary information, you know, they, Mark Zuckerberg tried to put a spin on it. He said, well, you know, we thought that we could partner with them and that this would be better for users. And so that's one thing. The second thing is that, I mean, my feeling is these CEOs feel like the laws as interpreted today work in their favor. The Instagram purchase, for example, was approved by the Federal Trade Commission. And in fact, Republicans on the committee said that openly, like, if this was such a problem, why did the Federal Trade Commission approve it, which, you know, is exactly the problem. And they just feel like they'll be able to fight this out among the regulators and in courts. And they, you know, the House Antitrust Subcommittee can bring up all these very clear harms, but in the absence of changing laws and changing personnel, they're kind of insulated, and they've spent lots and lots of money to get that.
So, okay. So what do you say? I mean, you say the clear harms. I mean, what do you say to someone who says, like, well, what's wrong with that? I mean, Facebook, you know, they bought Instagram and they have more users. So why can't they do that?
I mean, it's prima facie anti-competitive conduct. Like, you know, it is within, you cannot seek to acquire a monopoly. That is in Section 2 of the Sherman Antitrust Act. The fact that they were able to do it is kind of backwards looking justification.
We're losing you a little bit.
Hello, am I there?
Yeah, something weird is happening with your phone, but go ahead.
I'm sorry. The fact that they've kind of backwards justified it by saying that, you know, the FTC approved it. I mean, that's fine, but the law itself, if you read the letter of the law, they violated it. And, you know, Jeff Bezos said something similar. By the way, all these companies have acquired massive amounts of competition in order to, secure their power. Mark or Jeff Bezos said specifically that we acquire companies in order, you know, because of market position, which is illegal. Like, you can't do that. You can't just acquire a company so that you can monopolize a segment of the market. That is a violation of the Sherman Act as written. The Sherman Act as interpreted over the last 40 years is, you know, why I wrote my book. It's the reason that we've allowed these mergers to sort of be waved through, and why we're in the state that we're in with this massive amount of corporate power that affects our daily lives in myriad ways.
All right. So let's talk, I mean, let's talk about sort of from a practical standpoint, let's give an example for each of these companies as to, like, what, you know, what we could do and the benefits that would accrue from that. So Facebook, I mean, the one of them with things to do would be say, like, yeah, you're going to have to spin off Instagram, and you're going to have to, like, end stories, or, you know, or what exactly? Like, what would you do with Facebook to start with? I mean, I imagine also there would be a lot of, like, you can't use your data in the way that you're using it for advertising and whatnot. But what else would you do?
Right. I mean, spinoffs and divestitures are one. I think you do go after the business model I called a few years ago for just banning targeted advertising. This is the problem. You know, another thing that came up in the hearing was the difficulty of publishers to sell any form of advertising that's in any way valuable, because Facebook and Google have commandeered that digital ad market. One way to stop that is to say targeted advertising at a specific individual is not allowed. U.S. government has plenty of authority to regulate advertising. They do it all the time, tobacco ads and whatnot. And, you know, what this would do is allow publishers then to use the aggregate specialness of their audiences to sell ads. So, I mean, we're not banning market research. You can say that the Wall Street Journal readers are largely more affluent and they're interested in business, and so advertisers who cater to those individuals can join us, and they'd be likely to be favorable. That that's something that almost doesn't happen right now outside of a few isolated cases, because Facebook and Google can give you that precise market and track that precise person everywhere around the web. So it ruins the ability for an audience to be built on the basis of content and then to be able to afford to be able to finance that by selling advertising to that audience. So so that's one thing, in the case of Facebook.
All right, hold on. I want to make this clear, because I don't think this is a point that people really fully appreciate what it does to all of these publications. I mean, in the case of, let's say, if they got into the audio business, I guess, or whatever it was, it basically means that there's no, they could wipe me out in terms of advertising, because, right. The group of people that I'm attracting for this, or the, theoretically the relationship I have with the audience would be just overcome by, Google and Facebook knowing that, like, oh, these folks are, have been, bidet curious for whatever.
They've been purchasing. Yeah. They've been looking, scrolling bidet websites, fan sites, for days. And so they know to track those individuals. So why would the bidet company go to you? They would go to the people most likely to buy bidets.
And yes,
that is the larger problem. And by the way, we're seeing in the podcasting market, Spotify kind of taking over a lot of these networks, and the ad tech, which is to move into Google. Google owns both Google and also the ad exchange server where individuals buy advertising. And so they can use that to favor their own product. So it's a separation there of saying Google cannot run, websites where advertising is placed, and also the ad placement auction mechanism. That separation could be an example of one thing you can do.
Okay. And then Amazon, one of the big things would be to prevent them from both having the marketplace, being the marketplace, and then putting their own products and favoring those products in the marketplace.
Yeah, and I think a larger thing is banning predatory pricing, which is something that is actually already under the law, technically illegal, and that's selling things well below cost in order to monopolize a particular market segment, and then presumably raising those prices over time. And there's a guy named Shaul Sussman. I was with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, who has laid out a pretty convincing case that Amazon has for years engaged in exactly that, whether by themselves or through their third-party individuals who they tell, you have to lower your prices and give us the lowest price possible. This has had the effect of raising prices elsewhere, which, if you're under a consumer welfare standard where price is the important thing, if the effect of Amazon is raising prices elsewhere, then there's a plausible case even under the constrained kind of understanding of antitrust right now. So that's something to do. There's talk that Amazon Web Services essentially subsidizes the rest of the business lines, so you cut those business lines. I think that there needs to be some sort of rate regulation. What we've seen with Amazon, and this was brought out in the hearing, is that a few years ago, about 19% of sales of third-party sellers who sell on the Amazon marketplace was going to Amazon. And now that's up to 30%. And when Bezos was asked about this, he said, yeah, but they're getting more stuff from us, like fulfillment by Amazon. And what was left unsaid is that sellers report that they have to buy Amazon services in order to get better placement and get eyeballs on the website. And that's an illegal practice known as tying. You're saying that you have to not only go on our website, but you have to let us do the shipping and let us do the logistics in order for you, and pay us for that, in order for you to make a sale. And you can't just tie those things together. So, there's a credible antitrust case to be made against Amazon over that.
So Apple and Google. Google, obviously, you know, having targeting ads, having ads and search functions is a little bit problematic, right?
Monopolizing search. Also kind of a tying issue of, you know, website owners who believe that they can't get onto the top page of Google search without buying an ad, because ads now populate the first half of the page on Google search. And so you can't even optimize yourself for high placement in Google search. You have to pay them to be searchable, which is another form of tying. So that could be the basis of a lawsuit. With Apple, it's the App Store, where app developers report very high amounts of fees that have to be given to Apple in exchange for access to iPhone users with their apps. So,
true.
And that's been pretty well documented.
Been there, and very difficult. Like, they wouldn't even let us, when we did the app, our Majority Report app, they would not let us link to our subscription page. So, like, mm-hmm. You couldn't even leave the app if the destination was a page where they could decide to become a member. They would not allow us to do the app. And
so they're walling the garden so that what you're describing is sort of living under the private law of Apple. So Apple created this market, and now they govern it. And there's no sort of outside regulatory standards other than what Apple creates. It's kind of the fallacy of deregulation. There's no deregulation. There's regulation by Apple in this case.
Correct.
Or by Amazon or by Google or by Facebook. That's what happens when we get deregulation. It's now being done in the name of private interest for their own benefit, rather than the name of public interest for the public good.
And what do you say to the argument of, like, well, but if you do what you're talking about with Apple, where's their incentive to develop the iPhone?
the $700 that they make on the iPhone? That just seems like an absurd question. The majority of Apple's funding or revenue comes from the manufacturing and sale of hardware. The fact that they're leveraging this app market is just, you know, sort of an icing on the cake, and it's being done in a way that stunts the development and growth of entrepreneurs that you know, want to deliver their whatever talent or that they have using these apps.
I mean, I just, you know, because I think there are, you know, sort of people out there who just assume, like, well, if, you know, if Apple built it, why can't they completely control it regardless of what it does to the rest of society? And, you know, it is.
And I mean, I guess the answer is that we created a system 100 years ago that said that no one company can control society, can control markets in this fashion. We made a determination, and Congress has not repealed it, that competition is healthy, and the way in which a regulated capitalism can move forward, that these antitrust and anti-monopoly laws are essential so that you don't get runaway inequality, stagnant wages. Are all these things sounding familiar as to what we're experiencing right now? So you don't get all that stuff.
And we should say, you know, I just want to remind people too. I mean, because, you know, again, people go out and they're making arguments to their uncles or their, you know, their nieces, or I don't know why, you know, any of their friends, their coworkers, their family. We also have other, you know, laws in our society, like the president's not allowed to be a king or a queen, or, you know, I mean, like, society is set up with this. Right. These are all decisions that we make. There are no natural rights of a company. A company does not exist in nature. There are no natural rights. We decide what kind of society we want. We also, you know, say that meat processors can't, you know, if some rat feces fall into the hamburger, they can't sell it. there shouldn't be rat feces, you know, it's, even though that they have their own machines and whatnot. And
you know, another law that we created in the in the past is the RICO laws, racketeering and corruption laws. And when you watch these hearings, you really got the sense that what you were watching were a bunch of racketeers. They were talking about how they intimidate their rivals, how they create a climate of fear among their partners and suppliers. You know, there weren't a lot of consumers on display. It was just about how everybody that associates with these companies ends up, you know, in a method of fear against them. And, you know, we have racketeering laws to deal with that as well. So, you know, you're absolutely right. We decide to create this society, and no government has a, or no private government in terms of a corporation has a right to profit, has a right to control.
Give me a sense, and I know that we talked about this, but I mean, where do you think is Congress further out ahead of this than you thought that they were?
Well, I mean, I think Congress, in this case, you're talking about this subcommittee,
right?
Which is, you know, there are 15 people who, among the 435 members, who have really looked at this issue. They're the members of the subcommittee, and what they found was enough for them to be, you know, very aggressive towards these particular companies. Because, you know, this investigation was only about the tech industry, and our monopoly problem goes well beyond
right.
the tech industry, going into health and agriculture and transportation and what have you. But, you know, when they dug in on these issues, this is what they found. And the result of that is going to be a report. And the report is going to either suggest remedies for these companies or new legislation to deal with these companies or gaps in enforcement of the existing laws that the antitrust agencies, namely the Federal Trade Commission and the Justice Department, need to address. So it's going to be one of those three things, or probably all of those three things. And that's going to be the blueprint, I feel, for the next Congress and the next administration. So we'll have a new group come in, and there'll be a yardstick here. Here's a report that says these are the things that you have to undertake if you want to live up to this ideal notion that we need. We can't have concentrated power in the hands of a few, dictating the whims of our economy and our society. So the choice will be very clear.
All right. So let's just move on. One other quick topic while I got you here, just a couple minutes on this. And that is the post office. You and I have talked about the post office probably more than any two people that I've ever been aware of anyways over the
more
years.
More than the Postmaster General and the Deputy
I
Postmaster
mean,
General.
There have been multiple occasions where there was, I remember, you know, we were hoping that they would, that I think it was Obama would appoint the right people to the post office board of governors and talking about postal banking. I'm hoping to have the head of the post office workers union on in a couple of days and whatnot. But
yeah,
in the meantime, what's your sense? Like, how dire is this? Because I've had conversations with people just randomly. Like, you know, I was getting a pair of glasses and the guy was like, it's going to take 2 weeks because the post office has just been, you know, horrible lately. And a friend of mine right. who is, you know, trying to wait on some like some material because she's, you know, making some designing some stuff, and said like it's been sitting in the post office for a week and I can see it, like I'm tracking it, it's just not leaving the post office.
Yeah,
well, like
I mean, this is more than anecdotal. We know that the new postmaster general who's come in, his name's Louis DeJoy. He was the CEO of a logistics firm and also was a huge Trump donor. And he has come in and he's cut the ability for postal workers to use overtime. And he has instituted standards such that you go out with the mail that you have, and if there's other mail at the sorting office, you leave it behind. I mean, he has said that very directly in memos and in directives. And, you know, that feeds on itself. If you have, you know, mail keeps coming. So if you leave some behind one day, then you leave a little bit more the next day and a little bit more, and you get this tremendous backlog that we appear to be seeing. So it's not a joke. It's not just three people saying I'm having trouble getting my mail.
Right.
And, you know, it's important to say that before this point, there was no, like in international surveys, no international post office did better than the United States. I mean, anyone that's gone abroad and sent a postcard knows that it takes a long, long time for those postcards to get back. And that's kind of, the way in which certain countries operate. But it wasn't the way that the United States operated. I mean, postal, the post office was seen as a model of efficiency and reliability. And the attempt is clearly being made to rip that away.
And universality. I mean, this is the thing that's also amazing about it, yeah, is that every other country you compare this to do not have their, I mean, for the most part, do not have their population so spread out and having people live in such, you know, sort of like, you know, nether regions, as it were. And but how lasting? All right. So Joe Biden becomes president. Knock on wood. And on day one, new postmaster general, does everything get fixed? Or is this going to inhibit and you know, vote by mail is another issue. From my perspective, it seems like a twofer, right? Like they want to debilitate the post office. Short term, it's going to have the impact of making it very hard to get ballots in on time. But midterm, it's also going to sort of like turn people away from the post office because they don't know what you just told me. They just know like I can't rely on the post office anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, how elastic is that?
I don't know how you're going to be able to bounce back. I mean, this is really serious stuff. It's not, it's more than ballots. Right. It's these small businesses that rely on shipping for their entire business. It's prescription drugs that are sent often through the mail, more and more actually as pharmacies, become mail order pharmacies and, use the postal service for that purpose. This is a major short-term problem that goes even beyond the election, even though the election is obviously very important. Long-term, I mean, yes, they're trying to make the case for privatization, to give up the monopoly on the mailbox to UPS and FedEx and to put the post office, essentially destroy the post office.
Who's going to investigate this?
I mean, what's that?
Is there a congressional committee that is going to investigate this? I mean, you have a logistics guy come in, right? His whole business is designed to either make an operation like the post office of run efficiently or inefficiently. Like my guess is they just, you know, who knows? They must have done some type of operational study even before this guy got appointed that indicated here are some pressure points. If you do this or that, these two levers essentially that you pull, it's going to make the whole system, you know, it's going to slow the system to a crawl. Like someone should investigate.
The Postmaster General is actually meeting with Schumer and Pelosi And the two officials at the White House who are negotiating this coronavirus relief package, Meadows and Mnuchin, they're meeting today. So that's number one. I know Bill Pascrell and some other members on the Committee of Jurisdiction has demanded some answers.
What committee is
so
it?
We could see. I think it's Ways and Means. They want to look into this. In the Senate side, it's government, it's Homeland Security and Government Affairs, but I'm not sure exactly who the House Committee of Jurisdiction is.
Well,
I think it's Ways and Means.
David Dayan, we got to wrap up here. I got to tell you, the idea of Pelosi and Schumer talking and meeting about it, that guess what that doesn't do for me?
It's not great, but it's a high level. It does suggest a high level of attention. So we definitely need more congressional inquiry.
David Dayan, it is always a pleasure. Like I said at the top of this, everybody should be reading The American Prospect. B, everybody should be reading Unsanitized every morning. And C, you should get a bidet. Thanks for coming on.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. David Dayan, ladies and gentlemen. All right. We're not going to do, this is going to be completely seamless here. Is Aaron the highlighted one?
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. Let's bring him on. Ladies and gentlemen, Aaron Kleinman, he is the director of research at Future Now and at GiveSmart. And he's also, what is it, Bobby Big Wheel on Twitter?
Yeah, I chose that as my Deadspin username about 12 years ago, and it's kind of stuck.
There you go. Yeah. Welcome back to the program, Aaron. So I want to talk about the thing that you guys have put out. Where is it? The State of the States report. I want to talk about that in a moment, but let's go over what happened yesterday, because big deal, right? I mean, so big deal yesterday.
It was. And in the primaries yesterday, you saw, real patterns emerge in the Democratic and Republican primaries. In the Democratic primaries, what you really saw was that the primary voters want to see a sense of urgency. Democratic primary voters have by and large been marching in the streets, shoulder to shoulder, for the past few months, demanding a better life. And if they don't see a politician as either standing shoulder to shoulder with them, or as not sense, at the very least not sensing that same sense of urgency as them, then they will vote against them. And, I think obviously Cori Bush beating Lacey Clay was probably the biggest example of that. But, I've been on this show before and we've been talking about, this has been going on in Democratic legislative primaries in so many states, Pennsylvania, New York, New Mexico, for the past few months. It's a nationwide phenomenon that's happening where Democratic primary voters really expect that their representatives to deliver for them and feel the same sense of urgency as them. And then on the other hand, you have Republican primaries. And so the biggest profile one was the Kansas Senate race, but that's kind of an outlier. If you look at everything, it's also, this multi-million dollar thing where the national parties are involved and, that can kind of distort things a bit. But what we saw, there are three states that had primaries today where we're really involved, and that'd be Michigan, Kansas, and Arizona. In Michigan, you saw Republicans turn back well-funded, kind of DeVos-backed candidates in primaries for people who were really involved in like the reopen protests in Michigan. If you remember those back in April, really kind of like fringe right-winger storming the state capitol with assault weapons type stuff. In Kansas, you saw a lot of moderates in suburban districts lose their primaries to conservatives, and really, it will make it much easier for Democrats to break the Republican supermajority in that state. And then in Arizona, you had two really kind of like swingy state Senate districts where Republicans nominated QAnon believers. And so on the Republican side, you're kind of seeing Trump, you know, the party is increasingly looking like Trump. And I think there's a lot of talk about what happens to the Republican Party after Trump, whenever that happens. And I mean, he has made permanent changes to the party, and it reflects him now.
Well, first off, let me just say that, A, I've been here before, and I'm going to recognize that and just put down that marker. But I'm also going to say that Trump, this is not a function of Trump. This is, it seems to me, the natural progression of the Republican Party. Trump is a function of the natural progression of the Republican Party. It doesn't work the other way, it seems to me. Like this.
I agree with you on that. I mean, obviously the party has basically, as it has become increasingly in hoc to special interests, it has a kind of less and less appealing actual policy program. So it's had to lean more and more into nationalism, which is kind of how you end up with Trump and basically his band of cronies looting the federal government, and how the Republican Party just goes along with it. And so, yeah, you're right that he's basically left the party with that. And I think, but you know, when I come back to Trump and kind of his permanent effect on it, it's really just like the conspiracy fringe stuff of it, where, you know, that really has, you know, like the whole QAnon thing to me is, it really is shocking just how quickly that has taken hold in really mainstream Republican politics. And I think that is something that you can attribute to Trump.
Maybe, but also I would say in 1988, you had Rush Limbaugh talking about Hillary Clinton murdering Vince Foster and dragging his body into the park. I mean, you know, even pre-Trump, I remember specifically, I bet you Matt, and I don't know if Brendan was around at the time, but Dana Loesch, when she was doing her NRA TV, she had on, I just remember this moment, Ajit Pai, I think it was. Was that the guy? Is he the guy who was the FCC?
Reese's mug guy, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So when Ajit Pai was on there and they were talking about net neutrality, so this must have been 14, I can't remember when it was. She said to him in the course of a conversation, "I'm surprised you haven't been Vince Foster." That's it. That's all she said.
Yeah,
I'm surprised you haven't been Vince Fostered. And I asked these guys in the office, I'm like, do you have any idea what that means? Like, well, no idea whatsoever. And I had to explain to them the whole thing about, like, they think that Hillary Clinton killed Vince Foster and dragged his body into the park. And, like, you know, if she can say that on a radio show with the confidence that her audience is going to know what she's talking about in 2014, fully 25 years after the fact that Vince Foster died, maybe 21 years. There was a big strain of this in the party. Now, Donald Trump may have accelerated a little bit, and I don't want to get caught up on this point, but I just, you know, this is the trajectory the Republican Party has been on. Trump may have bent the curve a little bit upwards, or accelerated it, but it's fascinating.
That's fair. But I mean, it really, you know, it shows you that there's just very little resistance to that left anymore. Whereas, you know, I would say, listen, nobody in the Republican Party of the past 20 years was certainly trying to stop and say, stop making fools of yourself and going on Limbaugh. No, they'd go along with it. But now it's, you know, they are getting high off their own supply, basically. And, you know, the supposed adults in the room all actually think that, you know, John Podesta is running a child sex trafficking ring out of the basement of a DC pizza restaurant.
Correct.
And so without, like, there's just no guardrails left. And so that's kind of how you have, you know, basically this fringe taking over the party.
Okay. So that's happening on the right. And we're going to see, I mean, presumably we're going to see more of this. And that there may be just an inability at this point to push to beat that back on some level going down the road. I mean, we will see. Let me ask you this one dynamic. OK, that's sort of tied into that notion that the Republican Party continues to sort of like head towards the margins. Saw these some of these stats from that guy Wasserman on Twitter. In 2016, mm-hmm. suburban St. Louis County voted 55% to 39% for Hillary Clinton. 2018, it voted 62% to 36% for Claire McCaskill. She ended up losing anyways, but in 2020, it voted 73 to 27% to expand Medicaid. Are we seeing like how does that story relate to the QAnon story, or does it? Like, how much of a danger is there that we are getting, like what's going on there? Is that the PMCs are moving to the left, or is it that, or what?
I think that's exactly it. And, you know, I think, you know, polarization and ideology, it's not kind of a one-way street. It's a constant feedback loop. And so, you know, when Donald Trump polarizes, you know, you mentioned a suburban county in Missouri, for example, you know, he has polarized, you know, many of the kind of, you know, formerly maybe Mitt Romney voters, you know, minivan driving, you know, well-off professionals who, you know, kind of want, maybe don't want radical change, but, you know, they certainly don't believe, again, that, you know, Vince Foster was dragged into a park after Hillary Clinton murdered him. And so, you know, Donald Trump drives those people away from the Republican Party because he's so anathema to kind of, you know, their belief to kind of, you know, just, you know, he's crass, vulgar. He really kind of shows kind of this ugly nativism that they thought that they were above. But when he does that, they also kind of, you know, because of the nature of the two-party system, they're driven to the Democratic Party. And basically, in order to kind of fit in order to oppose Donald Trump, they also adopt the policy positions of the Democratic Party as well. And it's not something that just kind of happens right away. It's something that, you know, it's a gradual process. But I think, you know, a lot of the fears that I think some people on the left had of, you know, the fact that the party is, you know, moving to the, you know, is moving to its strength in the suburbs. You know, that means they'll move to the right. Well, no, that hasn't really happened. And then again, if you go back to our report, you'll see that a lot of these big, you know, battlegrounds, you know, in 2020 in the election, they, you know, especially in like state legislative races as well, they really tend to be in suburbs, and the candidates running there are not like pro austerity Mitt Romney types. I mean, they want to make it so that people can have affordable health care and good schools and clean water, you know, things that, you know, the Democratic Party, you know, has really stood for in the past to help improve people's lives.
Okay. So let's turn to that report. And is your report that you put out? I guess you put it out the end of July. Is it available to anybody?
It's available to anyone who wants it. It's on futurenow.org, our website. You can also follow me on Twitter, Bobby Bigwheel. I have it as my pinned tweet. You know, whatever is easiest for you. We just want you to download it and read it. It's for anyone to listen to.
That I find a little bit annoying, because I thought like I was getting like a special report that would make me seem smarter about this stuff.
The sneak preview.
Oh, all right. Well, all right. I guess that's something. But so in general, I mean, there's you basically look at how the electorate largely has changed in terms of demographics. You look at who within the electorate has changed. You look at what the impact of COVID and the George Floyd protest make. You also talk about the third party vote, and then you talk about the disco stew fallacy, which I did not know what that was, but I do know now, which is that I don't know who Stu was, but at one point it looked like disco records were, you know, had shot up to the charts in 1976. And if this trend holds, there's going to be nothing but disco. And disco was a bit of a blip.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
What trends are holding? Like, is the QAnon trend going to hold? Like, what trends are holding, A, broadly speaking, in terms of the electorate? And B, what's it going to happen in these? What are the key states to be looking at in terms of state elections, and where are they trending?
Yeah. So I think, you know, we look at kind of the 2012, 2016 trends, and we see, oh my God, Democrats are losing white working class voters in droves. You know, they're just going to keep leaving the Democratic Party. They really just need to kind of max out college educated voters and non-white voters as well. And, you know, a lot of people have assumed that that trend would hold. But what we actually have seen was in the 2018 midterms, Democrats' biggest gain among any demographic group was actually among white working class voters. And their biggest gains geographically came in rural areas. Now, what does that mean in practice? It means that, you know, rural areas would have gone from, you know, voting maybe 35% for Clinton to maybe 42% or something for another Democrat. But, you know, in a statewide election, that's a huge difference. If, you know, I mean, one thing I like to say is if Joe Biden gets Hillary Clinton's margins in the suburbs and John Kerry's margins in rural areas, he's winning in a landslide. And so, but another trend that people, you know, kind of assume will hold, but we touched on the report that really isn't, is Republicans keep making inroads among non-white voters, especially younger male non-white voters. And so when you're looking at kind of how, well, how does that manifest itself? And so, you know, obviously there's, you know, when we're looking at the battlefield, I think, you know, states like Iowa, for example, or Montana, or even Texas, which we're in, you know, there's, you know, there's so much room for growth for Democrats in areas that you might not think. And that, you know, again, a state like Iowa, if Joe Biden ends up disproportionately improving his standing with white voters, it's going to be in the middle of the pack of swing states. And so, you know, don't assume that all these past trends are going to kind of constantly hold, and look at kind of broadly where, you know, where the opportunities are for Democrats. And they're not all just kind of upscale suburbs. There might be in places like Benton Harbor, Michigan, or Muscatine, Iowa, or, you know, Flagstaff, Arizona. And so, again, I want to make sure that people keep an open mind that we don't quite know where exactly the closest races are going to be, but we kind of need to prepare for a wide range of outcomes and make sure that the Democrats in all those races are fully resourced.
Well, I just want to touch on the thing you said, that the Republicans are making inroads with men of color, ages 18 to 24. Is that what you said?
Not necessarily. I mean, I would say, maybe under like 40 or so. We've seen it, you know, it's a trend that's been manifesting itself. There are a lot of different theories about it, whether it's kind of, I think broadly it kind of ties, you know, to institutions in those communities, in some communities like the church for African Americans, for example, is losing power. And that has really been a pillar of Democratic strength in the past. And so that could be leading to some of it.
Now, when you say men of color, like when you say men of color, are we talking black people? Are we talking
black? I would say, you know, black, Latino. I haven't seen as many surveys of Asian or Native American. But broadly, there, you know, we have seen among, you know, non-white voters as a whole, you know, just Democrats are not achieving their Obama era margins among them. And again, you know, those were very high margins, and it's hard to kind of keep that going forever.
Right.
You know, it's just kind of, again, it's the nature of, you know, you don't assume that all these past trends will hold. And it is a dynamic, you know, the electors are kind of this dynamic, kind of tough to discern sometimes thing. And again, you know, the real main takeaway is that we have to be mindful that there's a broad array of potential areas where we can, you know, win state legislative seats and improve people's lives through state legislative seats, that, you know, this election should really be seen as a big opportunity in that regard.
I know your whole pitch is that if you want to, if you want your dollar to pack as much punch as possible, you should be looking at state races. Here's an opportunity. Give me three states and or races that, if, you know, I came to you and I said, Aaron, I want my dollar to make the biggest difference possibly, politically, who should I give it to? Like, what race do I want to contribute to that is going to flip a seat in a state, that will flip a legislator, that will get people Medicaid, that will get people, that will protect a woman's right to choose, that will allow for a higher minimum wage, and that, et cetera, et cetera.
All right. So I'm happy to give you three. So three, I think, of the really top ones are Arizona, Arizona, we are basically two seats shy of flipping the Senate, one of flipping the House there. You get a Democratic legislature there. That's been a site of really big education, funding protests. I would say North Carolina, where we're so close in the state house there. That's a state where narrow special interests led by this billionaire Art Pope really wreaked havoc on that state's infrastructure. And Montana, a state that a lot of people don't necessarily think of as a swing state, but it's also a state where it's really cheap, where you have a lot of great Democratic candidates, and where if Democrats can flip the House there, they can really make big strides in that state. And actually, in a few weeks, we'll be launching our GiveSmart program. So keep your eyes out for that. Again, I'll be futurenow.org or Bobby Big Wheel on Twitter. You can find it through either of those venues. And that's where we will actually be giving you maybe the top eight races at that moment where your dollar will go the furthest across the states where the campaign finance rules make it so that small donors make the biggest difference. And we really want to make sure that, if you want to make the biggest difference in, whatever state legislative race is possible, we want to be able to give you the places where really at that moment, the small donors make the biggest difference.
Aaron Kleinman, always a pleasure. Future Now, check it out. People can go and find that report that you made, and we'll keep an eye out for the GiveSmart recommendations.
All right.
Despite the disco stew fallacy, my projection of your of the value of you appearing on this show has been unwavering. So I'm glad to say.
I swear that's not a fallacy.
No. All right. Thanks. I appreciate it. Aaron. Take it easy. Bye.
Thanks so much, Sam. Take care. Bye.
All right, folks. We're gonna take a quick break. Head into the fun half. Gave you a bunch of free show today, ladies and gentlemen. But occasionally we do that. We never shortchange on the free show. I don't know why. I mean, I don't even know what shortchange would mean. We set out when we started this show, it was supposed to be 45 minutes. We never do 45 minutes. And then it was supposed to be, the whole show was supposed to be an hour and a half. Somehow it just kept growing and growing. So you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show. You also get extra content every single day, almost. Also, amquickie.com. Well, frankly, your membership on the Majority Report, it also supports AM Quickie at this point. Hopefully we're going to get it to the point where we can start to sell some advertising against it. It is, and people are really enjoying the show. So the more people who go there and check it out, amquickie.com. You can also see it on YouTube at our other YouTube channel, youtube.com/majorityreportlive. But you get it any podcast thing. And let me make a, I just got this IM. And from Cold Feet Chowder. Where did it go? Pac-Man at 917,000 YouTube subscribers, while MR is still at 910,000. The gap is growing. I don't know what is he doing over there?
He probably bought ads or something.
Did he buy ads?
YouTube ads.
I don't know what he's got going over there, folks. This is a problem. I know I'm getting emails saying that I shouldn't be so competitive with him, but I'm sorry. Everyone's got to go out there and tell your family members and your friends, subscribe to our YouTube channel. This is important stuff. So if you're listening to this, go subscribe to our YouTube channel. Tell your friends, tell your kids. Your kids should be. Should be forcing your kids to subscribe to this channel. All right, so check that out. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And remember, I want to continue to introduce you. I mean, we've introduced you many times to one of the coolest sponsors we've had, Hunt a Killer. It's a murder mystery subscription in a box. It's one of the most unique games out there, and it brings the fun of an escape room to your home. Check it out. Go to huntedkiller.com/majority. Use the promo code majority at checkout for 20% off your first box. That's huntedkiller.com/majority. Promo code majority. Also, check out Nomiki's show. You can find it at patreon.com/thenomiki show or youtube.com/thenomiki show. You know, we talk about Corey Bush, her big win in St. Louis. You can find the long interview that Nomiki did with Corey months ago. Check that out on her channel. And also just check out for this week's show. If you want to know where the next great progressive congresswoman is coming from, you've got to be watching Nomi's show. So check that out. Also, Jamie, you there?
Yes, I am. Is this me?
What's happening on the Antifada this week?
Hello. All right. Well, this week on the Antifada, we have a hot, fresh episode for you. I was away over the weekend, but we had Jake Flores filling in for me on the mic. They did a little interview with Tana Geneva, a writer for The Appeal and The Intercept, about all of the horrible malfeasance going on in the NYPD, their permissive culture towards rapists and other abusers, and the utter failure of local government to implement reforms or enforce the reforms that have been implemented. Also, they talk a little bit with Jake about his new podcast, Why You Mad, and theories of comedy and class war. Also, still good, our Hong Kong episode from last week. I'm proud that we did that. Oh, let me turn on my video. Made a few tankies mad, but I think most of the listeners appreciated the nuance that we explored. So those are both free to listen to right now. Patreon.com/TheAntifada or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Matt, what's happening on your end?
Last night we did an episode of TMBS with Alicia Brooks and David Griscom. We talked about Bolivia, talked about Venezuela, and we took a Q&A, sort of almost a return to a normal show-ish last night. So check that out at patreon.com/TMBS.
I assume you had on David Pakman for that?
No, Pakman has not joined the show yet. Yeah, Literary Hangover, twitch.tv/literaryhangover. I'll be streaming on there at some point, too.
All right. Quick break. Into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number.
Oh, sorry. I'll take that. 1 second, Brendan.
You can't just say whatever.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous? You're a little bit upset? You're riled up?
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my
my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up. Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
Hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.